Hello everyone, welcome back to my channel. Thank you so much for joining us for another conversation with Scott Ritter. You know what to do, just in case, follow me on Locals, join the community there, and also join my mailing list. Every other link, including to Scott's books, also the channel where you can see Scott interviewing his guests, you can find down below this video. And thank you so much, Scott, for finding time to join me. You're on the trip, I'm on the trip, but here we are.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Scott. So I want to start with Poland, because 2 days ago, Polish Prime Minister Morawiecki has extended until the February 28th next year the security alert, which is Bravo, and Charlie SRP. So it says that Bravo is the second highest of 4 security alerts and might be introduced when there is an increased threat of an event of a terrorist nature, or when such a threat is anticipated, but the target of the potential attack has not been identified. And it also covers Polish energy infrastructure, which is located outside of the country. Charlie CRP alert is the third highest of 4 security alerts introduced in event of terrorist threats that concerns public administration. So this is like a cyber attack, I believe, the Charlie one. Scott, I would like to know your thoughts. Why Polish Prime Minister would be doing such a thing?
I mean, frankly speaking, only he can answer that question. Look, Poland's in a very difficult situation right now. They helped instigate a crisis in Ukraine, and the crisis is not unfolded in a manner that is beneficial to Poland. They have an energy crisis. They have an economic crisis. They have a political crisis, and that's just at home. They have a refugee crisis that's only going to get worse. And then they have an internal domestic crisis that revolves around the empowerment of Polish nationalists who somehow view the devolving situation in Ukraine as an opportunity for Poland to reacquire the territory that's currently known as West Ukraine. And this is, you know, problematic. It's something that I think resonates emotionally with a segment of Polish population and therefore the politicians that come from this segment, but it's an unrealistic and indeed self-destructive trend. All of which, when it combines, creates a system of, a crisis situation in Poland. And political leaders oftentimes respond to crisis situations by diverting attention away or excusing the crisis as a form of, you know, a security threat and things of that nature. I don't know what intelligence he has received about specific terrorist incidents or, you know, potential. Is it real? Is it imagined? Is it manufactured? You know, Europe. The European Parliament just voted in a non-binding fashion to call Russia a state sponsor of terrorism. So maybe they're using that designation as a justification for elevating terror alert. I don't know. What I do know is that it's not conducive. These actions on the part of Poland aren't conducive to resolving the crisis that has emerged from the Ukrainian conflict. In fact, it'll seek to exacerbate the conflict rather than try to cure it.
Okay, so do you think that creating this extension could be a false flag for the Polish citizens to give them this idea, this illusion that there is such a threat, okay? And then creating that threat to respond to that threat?
I mean, yes. What I really think it is it's an excuse. It puts the Polish citizens in a mindset, an emergency mindset, mm-hmm. that allows the Polish government to implement security mechanisms that are designed, I believe, to control the Polish public. Because things are going to get tough in Poland. And the government does want to say, oh, well, we think you might riot in the streets because of energy shortages or this, that, and the other thing. So we're going to put troops in the streets. The Polish citizens will say, no, you can't do that. But if they say, no, we have a heightened terrorist threat alert, everybody needs to be scared, needs to be concerned, and we're simply doing these security measures for your protection, the Polish citizens might be more inclined to accept that.
Exactly, because they want to stay in power as long
everybody
as possible.
Everybody wants to stay in power.
So, Scott, I would like to ask you, because as you know, like I'm actually on the road. I haven't been following daily as I used to all the updates with Ukraine, but I would like to ask you about that situation with electric grid, Russia destroying the power and water infrastructure. How much of this has been already destroyed percentage-wise? Do you have an idea at this point? And what do you think, how far this will go? Because of course this will create a massive refugees wave, like massive wave. But what's the situation with this right now? If you can give us updates on this.
Well, I mean, it's hard because the, you know, we don't get specific targeting information from the Russians. They don't say, you know, we struck this facility with this battle damage assessment, et cetera. What we get is rough estimates. I think the numbers right now fluctuate between 40% and 70% of the Ukrainian grid being taken out. Sometimes it surges to 70%, then repairs are made and it drops back down to 40%, then new strikes take place. But the important thing people need to understand is there's a cumulative effect of the strikes. First of all, damage is now being done on Ukrainians' power grid that cannot be repaired. It's permanent damage, irreversible damage. The other thing is where it can be repaired, the Ukrainians are running out of repair components and spare capacity. There's a lot of struggle right now to redirect energy supplies from neighboring countries to provide. But if the grid, if the power grid can't handle it, it's not just a matter of, you know, gaining access to energy, but how do you distribute the energy? How do you get it to the people who need it? And the Russians appear to be continuing to target this kind of infrastructure with the goal of bringing it down to 100% elimination. I think the Russians right now are not in a mood to have sympathy with anybody in Ukraine at this point in time. Ukraine as a nation has made a decision to participate in a conflict with Russia together with the collective West. And the collective West has said that their goal is to kill as many Russians as possible and to inflict as much harm on the Russian people as possible. If that's your goal, then don't expect the Russian people to have sympathy for what happens to you in response to this. You know, the Russians didn't start this war by shutting out the lights. They didn't start this war by shutting down communications, by cutting off water. That's not what they did. They could have, and indeed, I personally believe should have. But Russia has its own approach towards the Ukrainian issue that delves into, you know, Russian history and the notion of Slavic brotherhood and all that, that people like me in the West, when I say we don't understand, of course, when I hear somebody say, I understand the words that they're saying, but I don't understand the sentiment. I don't understand the emotional connection that exists because I don't share it with them. I believe it's real, but I think Russia is getting beyond that hurdle, and they're in the hurdle of, we are going to wage war and this war is going to hurt you. And that's the tragic reality of the circumstance in Ukraine today.
So you think they're going to continue with this until it's 100% destroyed?
There's no reason not to. I mean, okay. it makes no sense. Russia is investing a considerable amount of resources into targeting this electric grid, precision guided munitions, etc. It makes no sense to expend this resource only to allow the Ukrainians to rebuild, because then you've wasted You've wasted that resource. Once you initiate a campaign of this nature, from a military perspective, you need to see it through to the bitter end. And so for all the resources that have been expended in order to ensure that they weren't wasted, Russia has to continue this attack to bring the grid down to zero and then to keep it from coming up. Otherwise, why are they doing what they're doing? It makes no sense.
So now this Crimea talk, and I've heard you in one of the interviews, you said, you know, this talk about they want to get back Crimea, etc. This is completely delusional, you said, like it's not possible. But I wonder, that's what I would like to ask you, that bridge that went through this terrorist attack, do you think there will be more terrorist attacks on Crimea? How do you see this, you know, in the future with that region? Is this dangerous place right now because it might be more attacks over there and they will try to have more explosions, for example?
I think Crimea is definitely at risk. I think it's a primary target for the Ukrainians. If they can find a way to take down the bridge, they will. If they can find the way to do damage to Crimean civilian infrastructure, they will. I think we're beyond theoretical. We're into the Ukrainians are actively trying to carry out these kinds of attacks, which is why, one, Russia is putting in place defenses against this. But defenses are never perfect. There's always the potential of a defense failing or somebody getting around it, et cetera. More importantly is the next phase of these combat operations as Russia brings into the region the partially mobilized troops, 300,000 plus. You know, one of the things the Russians have always said is that they plan on pushing the Ukrainians back so that places like Crimea, Donetsk, Luhansk are out of range of Ukrainian systems. And I think that's what we're going to see. Is that the Russians are going to focus on moving the Ukrainians away from Crimea, moving them away from Donetsk, moving them away from Zaporizhia. When I say moving them away, killing them in large numbers, slaughtering Ukrainian forces. This is no longer a special military operation. I know they call it that, but this is war. And the Russians are no longer in the business of seeking to minimize harm to Ukraine. Russia's in the business of delivering harm to Ukraine. This is going to hurt Ukraine. And it's sad that it's gotten to this stage, but that's where we are.
So now this question came, I didn't have it actually here ready for you. From Ukrainian standpoint, when this will be over?
That's up to Ukraine. Could end today, could literally end today. Ukraine could end it today, but they have to be realistic. They can't sit in fantasies.
Sorry to interrupt you, but how much it has to be destroyed or damaged or weakened for Ukraine to say, this is it? Is there such a point, like from your analysts?
If we leave it in the hands of Ukrainian politicians, it'll all be destroyed because they're ultra-nationalists. The same question could have been asked to Adolf Hitler's inner circle. How much of Germany has to be destroyed before you're willing to surrender? And the answer was all of Germany had to be destroyed. They fought to the bitter end. So when you have these ultra-nationalists who are influencing Zelensky, who has become himself an ultra-nationalist, they will fight to the bitter end. The only salvation for Ukraine, I believe, is in its military. Because the military, they understand reality. And I'll give you an example. The recent conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Armenian politicians were insisting on continuing the fight because of the political ramifications of surrendering Nagorno-Karabakh and things of that nature. The military stepped in and said, we can't continue the fight. Your words do not translate into military capacity. If we continue to fight, we're all going to die, and the Armenians are going to take, or the Azerbaijanis are going to take everything. We need peace now. And the military put that reality on the table. Fortunately, the Armenian politicians recognize this reality and acceded to it. I think in this current situation, at some point in time, the Ukrainian military, who I believe you know, they have professional, honorable senior officers, are going to wake up to the fact that there is no hope, that there is no, we're, you know, next phase where we can attack and push the Russians back. They're going to be looking at the total destruction of the Armenian, or of the Ukrainian military, and with it, the total destruction of Ukraine. At some point in time, a Ukrainian general has to say, if we wait for a Russian counterattack that is going to take Odessa, Nikolaev, Dnipropetrovsk, Kharkiv, and once they take it, we will never get it back, ever, forever, it's gone. That's the end of Ukraine. That's the death of a nation. Do we want that? Because we can't stop that from happening. We're no longer able to look our politicians in the eyes and say, yeah, it'll cost us a lot of manpower, but we can hold them back here. We can counterattack here. We can do this. At some point in time, the Ukrainian generals are going to have to acknowledge that in addition to losing everybody, they're going to lose the territory. Ukraine's going to die. And that at that point in time, a responsible Ukrainian general whose job is the defense of the nation has to say continued resistance doesn't defend the nation, it destroys the nation. And we have to stop fighting. And if Zelensky doesn't want to listen to them, then I think they take Zelensky out of the equation.
So military doesn't cooperate, or there is not enough men's power because that electric grid will be destroyed. A lot of people are leaving. They cannot control at the borders. Right? So there is not enough manpower, Scott, at some point.
Well, it's not that there's not enough manpower. Ukraine has a lot of manpower left. They're all going to die. There's not enough competent manpower. There's not enough organized manpower. There's not enough trained manpower. There's not enough equipped manpower. There's not enough combat capable manpower. The Ukrainian nation has the ability to mobilize more people. But what's happening now, the death rate on the battlefield is 1,000 dead a day, 1,000 dead a day. And it's going to get worse when the Russians attack. That number is going to go up to potentially 4,000 to 5,000 dead a day. When the Ukrainian armed forces, when the line breaks, they're in a rout and the Russians are mowing them down because they're not in the, they're not going to kill prisoners, but they're not in the mood of taking prisoners. Meaning that if you're running away, you know, in the past, as Ukrainian forces ran away, the Russians would stop firing. Now, as Ukraine forces run away, the Russians are going to pursue and they're going to kill them because they don't want them coming back. They don't want to let them regroup. And once that happens, history, that you know, the historical example, the destruction of Army Group Center in on the Eastern Front in 1944, the summer of 1944, when the German Army Group Center collapsed and the rout that followed, nearly a million Germans were killed because the Russians just overran them, slaughtered them. And I unfortunately see that future for the Ukrainian military.
Sorry, please. One more question I have for you, Scott. And this is about United States and US citizens. I would like to know, in your opinion, what US citizen can do to stop US government to send more money to Ukraine?
I mean, we have the theoretical and then we have the reality. The reality is nothing. There's nothing the US citizen can do to stop more money from being sent to Ukraine. We had our opportunity in the midterm elections, but this wasn't really an issue that was on the ballot. The US citizens didn't allow, first of all, I don't know if the majority of US citizens, I know people take polls, but I just don't think the average American citizen's waking up every morning going, we gotta stop sending money to Ukraine. They're waking up saying, we got to stop inflation. I got to find a way to make my paycheck go further. We got to stop high energy prices. We got to, you know, that's what they're focused on. They're not waking up going, we have to stop spending money in Ukraine. And until they do that, that's, you know, the politicians aren't going to be under any pressure to stop sending money to Ukraine. I know right now you have some Republicans, Marjorie Taylor Greene in the forefront, who are making noise about accounting. But here's the question, is this being done because she's really concerned about Ukraine and the money going to Ukraine and the weapons, or is it a political ploy where they recognize that there's some weakness on the side of the Democrats, and so they're going to exploit this for their own domestic political benefit? Because here's the problem Marjorie Taylor Greene's going to run into. Most Republicans voted to send that money to Ukraine, and they're still in power. So when she calls for an audit, it's not just going to hurt the Democratic Party. It's going to hurt those Republicans who voted in favor of this. So, you know, because that's the only way this comes. It has to be political pressure. Politicians have to be pressured to act. And I don't believe the American people are mobilized to do that right now. And I don't believe that doing the right thing, let's say Marjorie Taylor's doing the right thing to try and account for this money. Her party isn't going to support this, because it's going to hurt them as much as it hurts the Democrats when the truth comes out about the amount of money that was sent, the lack of accountability, et cetera. You know, yes, there was a Republican, Rand Paul, who stood up and demanded that there be an inspector general. No other Republicans supported him. None. Not in the Senate. So what? Now they're all going to say, oh, we were wrong. No politician likes to admit they were wrong. So I believe that the United States is going to continue to double down and send, you know, billions of dollars of aid to Ukraine, which is why Russia has no choice but to finish this conflict violently.
And I changed my mind. I have one more question.
That's your prerogative.
Thank you. I wonder, what do you think is the next conflict? So what next conflict the collective West will generate after Ukraine? Where?
Well, I used to be very worried about Taiwan. But I have to say, on November 26th, there were the equivalent of midterm elections in Taiwan. And the ruling party, the DPP, I think President Tsai is her name. I apologize if I'm getting that wrong. She made a mistake because she tried to seek a referendum on her cross-strait policy, that is the policy of Taiwan becoming de facto independent. It's the same mindset that had Nancy Pelosi travel in August and create this crisis. And I was concerned that that this was going to lead to a war very, very soon. And I believe I'm 100% correct. I believe the Chinese fed up and they're getting ready to make a military move. And it could have come as soon as this month, maybe early next year. Then this election came and she lost. She made it a referendum on her policies and she lost. The Kuomintang party, the opposition party, had a near sweep of the local election. Now, normally local elections aren't about foreign policy. They're about local issues, corruption, potholes, and thing that all local politicians have to deal with when they run. Even in Poland, when you run for mayor of Warsaw, you know, the people aren't asking about NATO policy. They're saying, what are you going to do about, the potholes in the street? What are you going to do about the homeless? What are you going to do about this? So normally that kind of election doesn't have this impact, but she made it a referendum on her policy and she lost. She had to resign as the head of the party. She's still president. She'll be president until 2024. But I believe that we have now, because of this election, the world has been granted a two-year reprieve, where China, because China doesn't want to go to war with Taiwan. China was being compelled to go to war with Taiwan, just like Russia was compelled to go to war with Ukraine because of the actions of the collective West. But I think because China doesn't want war, China is going to back off. I think we're going to have a two-year grace period where hopefully reasonable minds can come together so that we don't repeat this scenario in 2024 where the crisis elevates. But so I'm taking Taiwan off the table mm-hmm. right now. I for the first time, I feel really good about this. Watch come wrong and we go to war. That would be tragic, but I don't think I am. I think that this is and you saw it reflected when President Xi met with Biden. The Chinese impressed on the United States that the United States has gone too far with its rhetoric and its muscle flexing, that it was a very, very dangerous situation. And I think the United States at that time was like, yeah, but we've committed ourselves politically. I mean, it was tough because you lean so far forward supporting Taiwan, you can't back away without hurting Taiwan. But this election now gives the United States a chance to back away without being perceived as weak. It gives China a chance to back down without being perceived as weak. But I think both sides have an opportunity to separate themselves on this issue and have things calm down, which is good because, you know, I know Europe has made a lot of rhetoric. We just had some, you know, several people talk about the importance of decoupling Europe from China. Good luck, Europe. I mean, the European economy is a basket case, and they're going to decouple from one of their largest trading partners. Insanity. The problem is Europe. The next conflict is going to be a European conflict.
That's why I wanted to ask you: is it Serbia? Is it more? I mean, Turkey. Or I wouldn't say, okay, those regions, Serbia, Turkey, Iran.
You know, Iran, Iran has a very difficult internal problem right now that's being, I believe, exacerbated by Western interference. But I think Iran's going to handle this the way they've always handled it, unfortunately, which is brutal repression. And the theocracy will continue to survive. The theocracy has pivoted to the east. Iran is no longer playing the European game. And it's going to be that the divorce is going to be more complete after this current round of violence, because everything that's happening in Iran today is because of Western intelligence and security forces who are providing support to the Kurds, to monarchists, to the Mujahideen al-Khalq, who are based out of Albania. All of these guys are being supported by the West. And I think that when the Iranians finish dealing with this issue, they're done with the West. They don't want to have anything to do with the West, and they're going to be pivoting to Russian side. So Iran, I don't think, is on the front burner of crises. Turkey, we'll see about Syria, and the Kurds. Russia and Turkey have a very strange relationship. One that, on the one hand, you'd think they're the worst of enemies, with Turkey providing weaponry to Ukraine and Turkey supporting Islamic fundamentalists in Idlib province and in Syria. But on the other hand, they've just entered this deal about an energy hub, the production, mm-hmm. manufacture a new line. They're coordinating on grain supplies, fertilizer supplies. They have a complex relationship. One might call it a mature relationship, but it's, I think it's that nature of the relationship will prevent Turkey from crossing over into extreme conflict. I think the lesson of Ukraine is, for most people, war is hell. I mean, it's being driven home how bad it is, but not bad enough. See, the problem to me is Serbia is a dangerous situation, very dangerous situation, but I don't think the Serbs are insane. I don't think the Serbs want conflict. Serbs know what conflict is, and Serbs understand that a conflict with NATO and in Europe will only hurt Serbia. So I think the Serbs are going to be the mature party in the struggle with the Kosovars and also in Bosnia with the Bosnia-Serb issue. So I'm not fearful of that. I mean, there's always a chance that the Kosovars will overplay their hand and provoke a conflict, believing that NATO's there to back them up. To me, the two hotspots, the most dangerous places in Europe today, are Moldova and Western Ukraine. I'm very concerned about Polish ambitions in Western Ukraine. I think people are starting to wake up to the fact, we've talked about this before, but there's tens of thousands of Polish military personnel in Ukraine today. They're volunteers, or they're whatever you want to call them, but they're Polish military people who have been allowed to go into Ukraine wearing the Ukraine uniform. They're dying in large numbers, by the way. I mean, Poles have to understand that there's thousands of caskets coming home. Aren't there new cemeteries? Aren't the Polish people aware of the fact that there's a lot of dead Polish soldiers being put into the ground? And there's going to be even more when this conflict erupts. But the danger is, see, I don't believe that the Poles put those troops in Ukraine to die. I think they put them in Ukraine for two things. One, to get combat experience, to learn how to fight. Because with all due respect to the Polish military, you don't know how to fight. When was the last major war Poland was in? You know, nobody in their current, they have some limited experience in Iraq, some limited experience in Afghanistan, perhaps. But other than that, there's no combat experience in Poland. They're now getting tens of thousands of men combat experience on the front line, learning how to fight Russians. That's a very valuable thing. Two, if and when the time comes when Poland says, we want Western Ukraine, they can flip a switch. They don't have to deploy troops into Western Ukraine. They have them there already. And they flip a switch and they become Polish. And it's like a, you know, confronting the Russians with de facto. I think it's lunacy because all that's going to happen now is that instead of killing Polish soldiers disguised as Ukrainians on Ukrainian soil, the Russians will just shift to killing Polish soldiers on Ukrainian soil. And NATO isn't going to back Poland up. NATO isn't going to support this gambit. But I think the Poles, together with the Baltic states, are irresponsibly desperate enough to undertake this. So that's a problem. There's some speculation, I don't want to give too much credence to it, that one of the moves Russia might make with its with these new forces is to actually drive out of Belarus and seal off the Polish-Ukrainian border. I personally don't think that's a, that creates a second front. Logistical supplies are difficult. Lvov is a difficult target. I think, I don't believe it, but I mean, it the fact that you have the head of the Russian intelligence talking about Poland wanting to take over Western Ukraine, you have a military buildup there. It's a dangerous situation, a very dangerous situation. The other one is Transnistria and Moldova. Moldova is making more and more talk about, because again, their president is under tremendous political pressure. There's massive demonstrations in the streets of the Moldovan capital, asking, demanding her resignation, demanding new elections, et cetera. They're not happy with her, aggressive anti-Russian posture. And she's saying that the Transnistria, the breakaway republic, has to be reabsorbed, and the ammunition that's there, the old Soviet era ammunition, has to be done away with, removed. Ukrainians are starting to talk about, why do we tolerate this pro-Russian enclave on our border? Why don't we just attack it and get rid of it, eliminate it? Romania is flexing muscle, saying that they would support Moldova. And Russia is physically separated from Transnistria. So there's some people who might be thinking this is the time to act. And all they're going to do is guarantee that the Russians will move through Odessa and confront them there. And now we have an expanded war that goes into Moldova, dangerously could bring in Romania, Russian NATO conflict. And so those are the two things that keep me up. Transnistria and Western Ukraine, those are where I think the next hot spots, danger spots, with the potential of expanding the current conflict could come from.
Horrifying, Scott.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you so much for coming on today. To those of viewers who wonder why I'm all of a sudden in the dark, because it's not energy saving, actually. I know it's not funny, but it's just the rooms have this light that they switch off by itself. So that's what happened. But I'm actually leaving Poland in 2 days. For some time, I don't know for how long, but I will be still recording the videos and still absolutely following the informations and the updates, since I know the language, and it's very important to do that. Thank you so much, Scott, for finding time today, and you're on the travel, so I appreciate this very, very much. The links to find you will be down below this video. Anything you want to add before we disconnect, or?
Good luck with your travels. I hope everything goes well. Stay safe. And I look forward to talking to you the next time.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for watching. And we see you soon next time.